The Guardian.
Ho, 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 and welcome to Music Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alexis Petridis, and in this week's podcast, St Etienne's Bob Stanley gives us a glimpse of stocking and explains why the band are so fond of Christmas. Plus, as it is the season to be jolly, Singles Club goes all festive with our favourite Christmas tracks, and we pick out a few of our interview highlights from 2010. That's all in this week's Music Weekly. It's the week before Christmas, and there is an end-of-term feel to the podcast today. We've brought in our favourite Christmas tunes. I personally am maddened by an excess of eggnog and the excitement of the Secret Santa in the office. In the grotto, it says here, in the grotto are Santa's little helpers. Guardian Music's Rosie Swash is with me as always. It says here that I should ask you, have you been good this year, Rosie? Which sounds like something someone on the sex offenders register would say. Are you looking forward to Christmas, dear?
Yeah, that's better. Very, very much so. But I have a habit of getting ill at Christmas, which is really crap, so I'm a bit worried about that.
Oh, I tell you what, year before last, I caught the winter vomiting bug on Boxing Day. My God, that's a Christmas no one in our family will ever forget. I thought I'd just drunk too much. I actually thought you know what I mean? Gorged, you've totally foie gras'd your liver here.
Yeah.
Just by stuffing yourself with food and booze, and man, I was ill. Anyway, yes. Merry Christmas, everybody. And as was mentioned, St Etienne and indeed Guardian contributor Bob Stanley is here with us for the programme. Welcome, Bob. What you're a Christmas fan, aren't you? I've been reading the sleeve notes to St Etienne's Christmas album.
Yeah, Christmas fan. I mean, I'm sure most people are Christmas fans, but it's just sometimes you need to sort of feel like you have to stand up and say, I like Christmas.
What is it about the festive season that particularly does it for you?
Well, it's my birthday on Christmas Day, which helps quite a lot.
Yeah, quite.
Does it, though, or isn't that just an awful time to have your birthday because everybody forgets? It's like, oh, here's two.
Well, that's quite good because everyone thinks that's the case, but it's not. And obviously, I've never had to go to school and always get a nice dinner. And so, yeah, there's lots of upsides to it. And most people do remember.
If they're listening into this podcast, I'm sure they will do. You are here because St Etienne recently released a compilation of Christmas tracks through your fan club.
Yeah.
There's only 150 of them now left, or maybe less.
It's probably about that. I mean, we're going to be selling them at the gigs. I mean, we're going to put it online if it's not online already.
I think it is online, isn't it? I ordered it online.
Oh, good. So, it came through.
And they are available also at your current round of Christmas gigs. You have two left to do, which is Manchester tonight.
Yeah, the Ritz tonight and the Forum in London.
That's become kind of a Christmas tradition, the St Etienne Christmas tour.
We've done them sort of every other year, I suppose we do it, so people don't get sick of us. We tried New Year once. We realised we've got a bit of an ageing demographic of an audience because people really struggle to get babysitters on New Year's Eve, so we probably won't do that again.
It is quite a collection of Christmas tracks that you've put together. 15 tracks. It's a lot. I mean, that's a lot of Christmas songs.
Well, the first one we did was I was born on Christmas Day, which is like 93.
Mm-hmm.
And then over the years, we tend to do like Christmas fan club CDs because the Beatles used to do it, so good enough for them. and give them away. But as our profile, I'm not doing a very good sales job, honestly.
No, I was going to say.
Profile's not quite what it was, so we're selling them now.
Merry Christmas.
we've added like 7 new songs, and it's like 8 songs that have only been on fan club CDs before as well. So.
Okay, and let's kick off with hearing the first Christmas track that you did from 1993. This is I Was Born on Christmas Day. I was gutted. I was born on Christmas Day there by St Etienne. I was gutted that you didn't perform in Brighton the other week because I was led to believe that Tim Burgess's role on that would be taken by the Independent on Sunday's rock critic Simon Price.
Well, that's right, yeah.
Can he sing? I mean, he is from the land of song. He is Welsh, but... let's talk about, first of all, Christmas tracks in general, because obviously it's St Etienne. By making this album and putting out the fan club CDs and putting out a Christmas single some years ago, you are sort of upholding a kind of dying pop tradition, aren't you?
I don't know if it is dying, because I think a lot of people in recent years have done Christmas albums which in America anyway, which seems to just get, you know.
Oh, that's true, actually,
sort of like,
yes.
Sort of perennials, I suppose. You know, so I think it's Destiny's Child one, and Christina Aguilera did one, I think.
There's a lot of that kind of, yes, you're absolutely right, there's a lot of that kind of melismatic soul. It's a melismatic vocal soul Christmas. But in Britain, I mean, it was something that used to be, I mean, kind of everybody did them. I mean, at one point in the 70s up to the early 80s, it was almost like a default setting for any band, regardless of kind of credibility, whether you're a pop act or a rock act, everybody seemed to have to do them. And then that seemed to stop. Why do you think that was?
I really don't know. Maybe Shaky ruined it for everyone. I don't know.
Yeah.
There must have been some tipping point where Christmas songs suddenly became quite naff. But no, I don't really get it because... Well, one thing that really, really annoys me is the obvious way, I think, to get around the Simon Cowell thing is to do a decent Christmas song.
Absolutely, yeah.
Rather than doing...
If Take That made a Christmas record.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That would be the end of Simon Cowell's dominance.
Yeah, yeah. I was thinking Cliff last year. If he really wanted a Christmas number one, could have done one with Jedward. I don't know. That would have been amazing. That would have been awful.
No, I think that's a great idea. Cliff and Jedward.
Cliff and Rage Against the Machine together.
Cliff and Jedward covering Rage Against the Machine. It's just absolutely mind-blowing. Maybe Shaky did ruin it for everybody. I heard that because we were decorating our Christmas tree in the Petridis household last weekend, and we had Magic FM on. And I'm a big fan, as regular listeners to this podcast will know, of Magic FM. But God almighty, they hammer it. It's like, even then, and it's like whatever it is, 2 weeks before Christmas, 3 weeks before, every second record is a well-known Christmas tune on Magic FM.
Yeah.
And they played Merry Christmas Everybody by Shaky. I was listening to the lyrics, which I've never done before, and they're insane. At one point he says, I wish that every day was Christmas. What a nice way to spend the year. Is he fucking mental? I couldn't imagine anything worse. As he said that, I was struggling with some recalcitrant fairy lights. At which point Shaky piped up, what a lovely way to spend the year. What a nice way. But anyway, what do you think, Bob, makes a good Christmas record?
Several things. Sleigh bells.
Always sleigh bells.
Upbeat, but maybe slightly melancholy. Oof, gosh. Not mentioning religion.
Interesting. So there's no, we're not really going for a godless Christmas. That's actually true, isn't it? They're not very religious. All the famous kind of Merry Christmas Everybody and
no, all the Christmas song, even, you know, White Christmas. Yeah,
no,
none of them are really.
Absolutely.
Millennium Prayer or something. It's Saviour's Day. They don't get dug out every year. You see,
maybe that was the tipping point of the Christmas song. It was.
Did that get to number one? Millennium Prayer.
Yeah,
it did. Yeah. Man, it's a terrible record.
That makes you want X Factor to.
Yeah.
To be at number one.
Okay, well, let's hear another track from the St. Etienne Christmas album. This is, I think, my favourite track on the album. This is Snowbound on the South Bank. Bob, tell us a little bit about this tune. What inspired?
We spent a year at the South Bank with artists in residence making a film about Festival Hall and recording the soundtrack, and it was one of the snowy winters. So we weren't snowbound.
Literally snowbound.
We were trying to film on slush quite a lot of the time. And because of that, obviously, we had to come up with some music to fit those scenes in the film, and we've sort of turned that into a proper piece of music rather than a 15-second incidental piece.
Let's hear it. Snetty in there with the Snowbound on the South Bank from their Christmas album. Are there any kind of themes that run through your Christmas tracks, do you think, other than your sort of heathen godlessness?
Drinking usually gets quite a lot of mentions. Couple of quite some melancholy ones.
I was thinking back to when you did the Christmas EP, because I had those two instrumentals on there, which were pretty bleak.
Yeah.
Peterloo and Snowplow.
Yeah, well, Peterloo was about a famous massacre in Manchester. It wasn't a Christmas song, it just happened to be on the EP.
And is it weird? I mean, presumably you end up recording these songs not at Christmas. Presumably you're sat in a studio somewhere in the middle of August.
Yeah, I think we started in August, but by the time we finished, we're sort of it's like late September.
Is it a peculiar thing to try and get? I mean, you know, I suppose all Christmas telly and stuff like that is recorded in the middle of August as well, but I always think it must be a peculiar... thing to try and create the necessary ambiance, you know.
Yes, you're not feeling very festive, obviously.
No, if you're sitting around
you're
there
not eating mince pies. No, but I mean, we didn't do it in like high summer or anything, which I think the Slade one was recorded in New York in like in a particularly hot day, I think. Yeah,
that's absolutely fantastic. Well, look, let's close with one final track. Your choice. Which track would you pick? Which track should we play, Bob?
Let me think. Let's go for another melancholy one. Through the Winter.
Okay, this is Saint Etienne from the Christmas album, A Glimpse of Stocking. This is Through the Winter. Okay, it is time for our special festive singles club now. We've brought in our individual favourite Christmas tracks. Here's the first one, which is Rosie's Choice. That's Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, best known for backing Big Mark Ronson's Musicians of Choice on Amy Winehouse. Didn't you know that?
No, I didn't know
that. Dap Kings played on Back to Black. Amy Winehouse. Like, wow. You see what an education it is.
I'm going to leave right now.
And that's No Chimneys in the Projects, Rosie's Choice. Rosie, tell us why you brought that in.
I've discovered this song. It's actually from last year, even though it sounds like it was made 40 years ago. On a mixtape that Michael Han and the Han family made and put a compilation of Christmas songs that he could distribute to his colleagues, and that's true.
My copy of that was obviously lost in the post. Thank you, Michael.
Anyway, I like that it's soul and funk, which is not really something that you ever associate with Christmas. So it's a little incongruous. But I like the message. It's really sweet. It's basic. You know, I didn't know when I saw the title, I thought, is it just going to be this horrific kind of mid-90s Bronx?
Gloom.
Or just something really horrible, but it's just a mother trying to protect her child from reality for a bit longer.
A chimney will appear.
Exactly, and it made me think of the year that I discovered that Santa Claus didn't exist, which wasn't actually a painful experience. It was just like, oh, of course, that makes total sense moment.
It does.
Going through the Argos catalogue, ticking various things. I was 14, no, I wasn't. I was 8 or 9. I was ticking like Barbie's houses and things like that. And I was like, look, Mum. She's just like, oh, it's going to cost quite a lot of money. I wouldn't bank on getting it. I was, hey, but Christmas, where's the budget for Santa
really?
Claus? And then suddenly realised that actually no Santa Claus existed. So that's my discovery.
Wow. Moving swiftly on.
I'm glad
you shared that with us.
I thought you might want to tell me when you discovered that Santa Claus. I can't remember. Now, in which case
thanks for ruining my Christmas. Thanks for telling me. I can't remember when I found out that Santa didn't exist. Bobby, do you have any?
No. I think it was a similar thing where it was like it's logical that Santa doesn't exist. Yeah. And
it wasn't like Santa doesn't exist, and actually, it's not really your birthday today.
And we're not your parents. So I think that's an interesting record because it exists in a tradition. I don't know if you've ever heard James Brown's Christmas album featuring Santa Claus Go to the Ghetto First, which is it's a great thing. Bob, did you like that Sharon Jones track?
I did. I was thinking there's a Rotary Connection album, which is a great album from about 1970, which again is like sort of like a Charles Stepney's soul album. There's a song on that where the lyric is, I don't know why Santa comes down the chimney. If he was cool, he'd come through the door.
That's brilliant. That's absolutely
true.
Fantastic.
True.
Where can people find this track, Rosie, should they wish to?
I think if you Google it, you can go
if
to...
If they're not one of Michael Hann's special friends, special Christmas mix.
Befriend Michael Hann, it's the only thing to do. If you Google it with NPR, then it will come up on National Public Radio and it's still up from last year and you can listen to it.
Fantastic. Okay, we will move on. This one is Bob's Choice.
Soft words to say, I'll miss you and I will stay a while. You'll see it in my eyes and when I smile. If I get home will stay. If I get home on Christmas Day.
The King. Elvis singing If I Get Home on Christmas Day. Bob, you brought that in. Why is that your favourite Christmas record?
I don't know, I found myself welling up. Yeah. Listening to it then. Yeah. Obviously, it's like it's about, you know, getting together at Christmas. But there's something in his delivery where, or and the arrangement, I think, where you just get the feeling he's probably not going to be home, and he keeps saying if, which gives it a really, really nice edge as well.
Absolutely. I also like the fact that it's got that kind of everything but the kitchen sink production. You know, you've got those kind of like ooh, backing vocals in there, and which you should sort of pile it on, I think, at Christmas as well. I really like that, Rosie. I'm not that conversant with the King's Christmas records at all.
It's very good.
Yeah, I should definitely.
It's like a 50s album and an early 70s album.
Oh, this is obviously from the early 70s one. Rosie, was that up your street?
Yeah, I do really like it. People are still making Christmas records at the moment, but they try to do clever things with them or different things with them. So you've got
ironic,
or you've got I don't know if it definitely is ironic, but Hertz have got a record. Well, I think it is, which is a Christmas Feels Like New Year's Day or something like that.
Christmas Feels Like New Year's Day, 1984.
Yeah, in Hertz's case. Yeah. But unfortunately, it doesn't sound like, you know, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, which would be great. It's just a really lame tune. Or Coldplay have done you know, their Christmas single, and it's all about a married couple falling out on Christmas Day. And there is that element to Christmas that a lot of people find it very painful. But there was a time when it was just records like this, and you just... And surely that's what Christmas Day is all about. You just shut the doors, your own little world.
I think that's really true. I think that it's almost difficult to overdo the sort of syrup and sentiment on a Christmas record. You know what I mean? Because you are in this kind of heightened emotional state a lot of the time because you're drunk. That's really when you're listening to these things, you know. But I was just... last year, this is a true story, for one reason or another, my wife had just given birth to our youngest.
I can explain how that happened, daughter. By the way, later.
No, that wasn't the mysterious bit. When a man really loves a lady. And I happened to be in the car with Magic FM on, and they played A Spaceman Came Travelling, the Christa Burr song, and I started to cry.
Oh.
It was something to do with the spaceman. I don't actually understand what's going on in that song. I'm not 100% certain, but I started crying anyway. What the sort of plot of it, a spaceman comes down, and I think he sees Jesus. I think he sees Jesus born in the manger. He sees a mother and her baby, and then it goes back up to space or something, whatever. But yeah, it's kind of a sentimental thing, and it affected me very much. Driving Home for Christmas as well by Chris Rea gets me every time. I think that's a great thing. No, I really like that. Elvis singing If I Get Home on Christmas Day from his 1970 early 70s Christmas album. And finally, here's my choice. That was Low from their Christmas EP with Just Like Christmas, an EP which also contains a great sort of fuzzed out shoegazing cover of Little Drummer Boy, which is was used, I think, on a Gap advert. And I just really like that record. I think it's got a little bit of the spirit of the Phil Spector Christmas album, obviously in the sound, but it's done in that kind of slightly lo-fi way. And it's got what Bob was talking about earlier, the uplifting and melancholy thing going on in it, insofar as what the lyrics are actually saying is they're driving through, you know, somewhere in Scandinavia, obviously on tour, and it's all snowy and wonderful, and somebody says, it's just like Christmas.
Mm.
And they go, but no, it isn't like Christmas. We get to Oslo, and it's horrible, and all the snow's melted, and it's slushy, and everybody's arguing, and da-da-da-da-da.
And you don't fit in your bed. That's a good line.
Yeah, absolutely. And which is a true thing, you know, if you've got to go back to your folks for Christmas, and someone says, this is just like Christmas. And yet, it isn't sort of piling on the kind of... It's not like the Coldplay thing. I just really, really, really like that record. I nearly brought in Christmas wrapping by the Waitresses, which it's never Christmas in the Petrides household until that's been played. But I went for that. Bob, is that something? Is that a record you like?
Oh yeah, I love it. It's got all the atmosphere, and it's not sly, but it's you know, it's talking about it's Christmas because it's not everything's perfect.
Absolutely, Rosie.
I can't remember when I first heard this, but didn't know it was Low, and was obviously very surprised. It's by them because it doesn't say. If you've never heard Low before, this is not a good introduction
to their output. It was the first low record I ever heard, and I bought some other albums by them. I was like, oh, what's all this about? The rest of the oeuvre hasn't grabbed me at all.
I know, I do quite like Low. I mean, they're a very serious band in a lot of ways, so I do like it when bands just kind of submit to the joy of Christmas, and you can imagine them sitting around in paper hats reading shitcracker jokes and them kind of saying, we're just like everyone else on the planet. I like that element to it, especially Low.
I think it's a great thing. Somebody posted this song on Twitter, so for someone that I follow on Twitter is doing like a Christmas advent calendar, and somebody complained, said, yeah, well, you know, this is good, but a lot of Low's other Christmas songs, you know, have got a lot of God in them. And I was like, yeah, these Mormons. It's just God with Mormons, isn't it? You know, low are Mormons, in case you didn't know that. Well, we would all like to know about any other unknown Christmas gems that we should be listening to. I'm always intrigued of hearing, you know what I mean? Somebody can dig up a good old Christmas, you know what I mean? A Christmas track I haven't heard or something
should
like that.
Hear Michael Hand's compilation.
Yeah, well, I'm not allowed to.
There's David Gates one on Radio 2.
Really?
Yesterday.
I didn't know that David got what, a more a recent thing.
I don't know. I heard it. It sounded 70s, I'd say. But
that sounds brilliant.
Never heard it. It was very nice.
That's okay. We got David Gates. Anybody out there got anything else? Leave us a message on the blog. Post your reviews of our tracks too. The links are all at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly. To round off this week's show, we thought we'd look back at some of the highlights from this year's Music Weekly programmes and pick out a couple of our favourite interviews from the year. Rosie, which interviews from this year have stuck in your head and why?
Well, I think one of the best records of the year, which won't make it onto the top 10 albums of the Guardian's top 10 albums of the year, unfortunately, is the Gil Scott-Heron record, I Knew
That's
Him.
That's not going to make it in the top 10. And yeah, obviously Britain as a whole is on tenterhooks waiting to find out what the Guardian's album of the year is.
But it did make it onto a lot of individual people's lists, but it's... Not only is it a great album, I still find it incredible to listen to, the story behind how it was made is great. Unfortunately, we didn't get Gil on the phone. But we did get Richard Russell, who owns XL Records, which put out the record.
And he produced it as well.
And he produced it, and it was his kind of labour of love, and he went off to try and locate Gil Scott-Heron and make this record, so it's just a really incredible story.
Me and the devil,
there's also there's quite a few interludes on the album which are just snatches of him talking or snatches of his part in a conversation. For example, Parents, which is him just explaining that he believes that your parents live on through their children in their blood.
I believe that the spirits are your parents and their parents and their parents and their parents, and they are in your bloodstream and they run through your body constantly because they want you to live on because they want to live on.
I just wondered how that was recorded. Was that just you sitting around with him, taking the best parts of what he has to say?
Yeah, that's it. We had basically when we were in the control room in the studio. Sorry, when he wasn't in the live room or in the vocal booth, when he was sitting with me and Lawson, who's the engineer, in between takes and just kind of sitting around. We used to have these conversations. They were so incredible. Well, or at least the stuff he was saying was so incredible. Well, the stuff I was saying would have been the normal type of stuff that I said. But the stuff that he was saying was just so, I mean, just amazing and just extraordinary. And every word was so interesting that after a while, I realized that it was worth sticking a microphone in that room. And just, I mean, I asked him about it, and he wasn't really bothered either way. And I think the moment we put a microphone in the control room, he totally forgot about it. So we carry on having these conversations, and you know, when Gil does his takes, I mean, he's such a good performer musically. He's so strong. You'd never really, you know, if he was playing piano or singing, you'd never really do that many takes. You'd get it quite easily, but you'd also but you know, you'd have to be in the right mood to do that. And you'd sort of, and so there was quite a lot of, you know, we'd sit around and chat, and so those interludes are just some of the bits of it that were like just interesting. And so I would edit them and then play them to him, and I think he'd often be slightly surprised at what I found to be fascinating, but I knew that other people would find it fascinating.
Standing in the ruins of another black man's life, or flying through the valley separating day and night, I am death.
Richard Russell there discussing his fairly remarkable, I think, coaxing of Gil Scott-Heron back into the studio. And I mean, you know, it has continued rather well, that album. You know, he's come over, he's done gigs, he's turned up. There is a remix version, Jamie from the XX remixed the whole album. I think it's coming out in a couple of months' time. And by all accounts, it's amazing. I haven't heard it myself.
But no, I haven't heard it.
I know someone who has, and they said it's brilliant, and it's kind of like sort of hints of early 90s kind of jungle, as it used to be known, sort of Omni Trio and people like that on there, which is an interesting kind of thing.
Someone who is part of the Brits Committee of Voters tells me that Gil Scott-Heron is a contender for Newcomer of the Year. International Newcomer of the Year,
no.
Whatever that. Which is because I'm New Here is the first of his records to ever enter the top 40 in the UK.
Is that true?
How amazing would that be if he actually got the award? I mean, it would be ridiculous.
It
Newcomer.
Would be insane. Yeah. Who is he up against? Ollie Murs. Brilliant.
Who knows?
That's absolutely fantastic. Well, we should move on from Brit's Best Newcomer nominee, Gil Scott-Heron, to another interview. My choice of the interviews of the year was the interview you did with the rapper, Drake. I just think there's a whole sort of strand of interviews that basically consist of interviewees sort of being very charming towards you, which they never are to me. I can't imagine why. And it was down to Drake and Brian Ferry, who answered every single one of your questions, Brian Ferry, with this little self-satisfied little... Well, they're just... And now I cannot listen to Roxy Music. I had a load of Roxy Music on the other night and was listening to Siren by Roxy Music, and all I could think of, you know, each track would start, Both Ends Burning, brilliant song, you know. And all I could think of was Brian Ferry and this, well, doing this sort of little charming
Roxy
laugh.
Music.
He spoiled it for himself, frankly.
Yeah.
But yeah, let's go and have a little listen to... The remarkable philosophy of Drake.
Yeah, it was one of those weird interview situations where you're not actually allowed to listen to the album that you're there
That's
to
right,
ask
yes, yes.
artists about. So I turned up at this very juicy Central London hotel, was planted in the corner of the room where Drake and his entourage were playing computer games, and given a pair of headphones and an iPod, and had to sit there and listen to it while looking at him, which is very strange. So I didn't really have time to get my head around the album on one listen, so I asked him to explain it to me.
I'm more than just an option.
Hey.
Refuse to be forgotten.
It's sort of a representation of where I'm at in my life right now. The main theme on this album is, you know, the search for love amidst all that's going on. I try and paint a very vivid picture. I don't know if, you know, I know a lot of people have gone through what I'm going through as far as, you know, the rising stardom, but I just don't know if anyone's been mentally conscious enough to document it while it's happening, as opposed to looking back on it. It's fun. I feel like there's a positive message behind it, which is, you know, it's cool to be yourself.
I better find your loving. I better find your heart. I better find your loving. I better find your heart.
There's a lot of eclectic sounds on there. I want people to kind of listen to it and then be able to listen to it again and rediscover something and then put it down for a week and then pick it back up and be like, oh man, I don't even feel like I heard this song yet, or I didn't feel like I heard this verse yet. You know, there's a lot of, it's one of those, it's a complex body of work, and it's going to take some time to digest.
This one's for you. Baby, you my everything. You all I ever wanted. We could do it real big, bigger than you ever done it. You be up on everything. Love the whole thing, never own it. I want this forever. I swear I could spend whatever on it. Cause she hold me down every time I hit up. When I get right, I promise that we gon' live it up. She made me beg for it till she give it up. And I say the same thing every single time. I say, you the best. You the best. You the best. You the best. You the, you the best. You the, you the best.
Do you think that there's been a bit of a sea change in the last few years in hip-hop, where it's become a lot more introspective, a lot, not necessarily more emotional, but certainly your album is very psychologically introspective?
The introspective sort of hip-hop, we found a way to make it appealing, that's all. I think it's always been there, because I know I was listening to it when I wasn't where I am. I think, like, myself and, you know, Kanye do, like, a great job of making it commercially appealing but still making it, like, life music. And I definitely think that it's come to the forefront now. It's, like, the desired brand of hip-hop. Wayne does it, too, a lot. He just does it in a more fun commercial way, you know? Jay, too. Though Jay still talks about certain topics that aren't necessarily, you know, kosher on all in all walks of life, but he does it in a very intelligent way. So I just think that that's what people desire, and I think that's a great thing because I think it's going to force new rappers and anyone who wants to be successful to like really think their stuff through, which is important. James by cologne, honey, I put on,
make 'em run and tell their friends like a marathon. Oh, that was Drake. I was stunned into silence by the honey tones of Drake there. Take something to emerge out of the hip-hop scene and seem quite self-regarding in comparison to the rest of it, but there you go. Good old Drake. The other highlight, I suppose, would have to be our interview with the Beach House. That went rather well, didn't it?
It did. It was right at the beginning of the year, and Victoria is from Beach House, a very interesting interviewee. It's another record which a lot of people have fallen in love with this year, and unfortunately didn't make it in our top 10. I think it's at number 11, so it very nearly did. In fact, it was Bob's top 10 going in that pushed it out of the number 10 slot.
Wow.
Reveal.
Sorry, Bennett.
<Yeah. laughs> for me personally, I did love this record, but it didn't seem to me too much of a progression from their first two records. So I wasn't completely sure why it was this one that suddenly everybody was talking about, whether it's just because they've been around for long enough now or because the mood of a lot of music this year is very of the Beach House ilk.
By which you mean it sounds a bit like My Bloody Valentine.
No, sorry to say, more the kind of, you know, the lo-fi chill wave stuff and all that, which you think
which sounds like My Bloody Valentine, yeah. Okay. Anyway, here they are, explaining.
With Chris, and he's worked with TV on the radio and yeah and things like that, and he's a very accomplished person and very good at what he does, but with Chris understood that we have a very clear sense of how we want to sound, and we've always had that from the start. I think that he was really good at getting us to do takes. You know, he got really great live takes out of us. It's not Chris Cody the producer stamping Beach House with his sound. It's Beach House having an idea of a sound and finally being able to get that sound, because we're surrounded pretty much by these instruments that we love very much. They're not expensive. It's not expensive gear or fancy vintage gear necessarily. It's just the junk, the keyboards, the organs that we've collected over the years.
Could you tell me what you called it junk there? What some of the what your primary junk is to make that very distinctive Beach House sound?
The instruments that we use on Teen Dream are the same instruments we've been using since the beginning. You know, Alex's guitar and my, you know, Yamaha white keyboard. They are family organs probably from the 70s, you know, that are not very valuable. But for us, it's valuable in the sense of what it was given to us, which is sort of priceless. Don't forget the last minute, all
I take it back, that doesn't sound that much like My Bloody Valentine. Spirit of My Bloody Valentine hovers over.
Just to extend that Victoria was saying there was Chris Cody who produced the record, which is part of the reason that people, you know, part of the big production behind that big record.
Okay. Well, look, you said this has been edged out of the Guardian Music albums of 2010, top 10. What's number one?
Janelle Monáe, The Arch Android.
Bob, what was your album of the year?
It was Janelle Monáe.
It's all down to Bob.
Okay, what came second?
Kanye West.
Right, okay.
Yeah, neither of those were in your top 10, were they?
Janelle Monáe was.
Oh, right.
Kanye West, no.
No, not a fan of that.
It's not I'm not a fan of it. It's just that I was dead honest with my top 10 and I put in things that I've actually listened to.
Yeah, exactly.
Rather than, you know, to me, and stuff that I thought was a critic, you know what I mean?
Why Hot Chip were the top of mine. Because is the album that I've listened to most this year.
I'm not for a minute suggesting, Bob, that you did anything different, by the way, by saying that. It's like
by putting Rihanna in.
Did you put Rihanna's album in?
Yeah.
Wow. The other thing that happens at this time of year is you realise how many sort of acclaimed albums you haven't actually heard, even if you're in a position such as we are of being, you know, rock critics and getting a lot of stuff sent to you.
I didn't really know much about the John Grant record before it started appearing on people's end of years list, and I did quite like it.
Yeah, I think it's all right.
Yeah, I do.
I'm going to be honest with you, I put it on the other day and I was like...
Totally worthwhile, these polls, aren't they?
No, but it's good because you get to hear... I'm trying to think what I heard that I really like that I hadn't heard previously. I can't think of anything. But there was some stuff. But no, the John Grant thing, I put it on. You know, I hadn't heard it. Put it on. This was good, but just I couldn't quite get with the You know what I mean?
I know.
People are just really, really into that.
This made me think of Rufus Wainwright in the early days.
I think it was oversold to me as a soft rock album. People going, it sounds like the Carpenters.
So,
and I was like, hey, here we go. Yeah. It's going to be the Carpenters. You know, you're a fan of that album, Bobby. You, John Grant? No,
I'm not familiar with it. I like the Rumour album, which is probably not very fashionable.
That really does sound like the Carpenters, doesn't it? Yeah, she's a contender for the Guardian first album, debut album.
Award. Which we're debating next year.
Okay, before we go, just a quick look back at some of the comments from the last two programmes. We didn't have time to squeeze in any last week, so we couldn't show up talking about John Lennon. There was lots of discussion on last week's Music Weekly page about the best Beatles and John Lennon stories and tracks, following our special on the man with John Harris contributing. Hannah Baby, however, posted this comment, bringing everyone back down to earth. Surely Lennon's time has gone. Has none of us moved on from the righteous mouthings of a not especially pleasant man? His wife was and is an artistic fraud slash joke. At least John wrote some wonderful songs, but enough already. We make more... This is the bit where her argument diversifies somewhat. We make more fuss over a dead man than we do over Sir Paul, who for all his whimsy is still alive, kicking and producing listenable music without the philosophical drag lines of Lennon.
That's one way to describe McCartney's output.
Listenable.
Listenable with no philosophy.
The unphilosophical but listenable Paul McCartney. Elsewhere, Zeb places a scene I mentioned last week of Yoko bossing people about in the studio. He pinpoints the right song. I think it's... Is it How Do You Sleep? I can't remember what he says, but definitely worth checking that out if you're...
And she says, in my massive Harrods bed, how do you sleep? Sorry.
There are many other good comments too, worth a read if you get the chance. Jumping back to 2 weeks ago, if you can remember that far back, when I wasn't here, Cran 1 said of Singles Club, re the Mannix tune. Before it was announced it was the Mannix, I thought it was a new Take That tune. Equally impressed as if it had been Take That. Nice one, thank you, Cran 1. And Chaz and Dave, who I hope are the Chaz and Dave. I really like the idea of the Rockney duo sharing a computer. Anyway, Chaz and Dave sharing a computer, arguing and discussing 100 in the Hands, which is also a great image. 100 in the Hands were an interesting sounding band. I could hear early 80s Robert Smith, Susie Undertones. Very true. It's been said before, but the current musical trends seem to reflect very much the political climate and overall public mood. Interesting. Are they? I'm not so sure they are.
Because we've had two pieces this week in The Guardian saying that that is in fact not the case, that the music world has been pretty silent.
Thus far,
yeah.
Well, Chaz and Dave disagree.
Come on, Chaz and Dave, the world's waiting for your protest record.
That would be amazing. Chaz and Dave's Ghost Town. Chaz and Dave should cover Ghost Town. That's the way to bow out. That would be absolutely... That put that in the charts, that would knock Cowell off number one. It really is beginning to feel like a rerun of 1982. I certainly agree that the world outside your window, as Band-Aid would have said, is starting to feel a bit like...
That's 1982. That's when Christmas records went properly crap.
Band-Aid 2. That's amazing. That's been written out of history. We're about Stock Aitken and Waterman are furious. Which is not a phrase you hear that often. But yeah, that's an amazing record. It's got like Big Fun on it and stuff like that. Anyway, this from the Clockwork Ringmaster. Long-time listener, first-time poster. Does anyone else feel like the Rosie Pods, sans Alexis, are a bit like the Oasis tracks with Noel singing? Not better or worse, just different. Rosie's last pod was Sunday Morning Call, the worst track Oasis have ever recorded, smashing. Which Liam track will Alexis's return evoke? I shiver in anticipation. I like to think this podcast has been Little James. He didn't post what track he thought my return evoked.
He preceded that line in the post by saying, I'm sorry if this comparison has been made before, but I can categorically say I've never been compared to Noel Gallagher ever before.
A lot of people say to me, you're quite like Liam Gallagher. Similar, very similar. Amazing photographs of Liam Gallagher in the current issue of the NME.
I haven't seen it. With BDI,
rocking this kind of amazing sort of bowl cut. Just remarkable hairstyle, like proper, like woman's 60s haircut. And
woman in her 60s haircut.
actually looks like sort of Mary Quant or something in 1960. And wearing a leopard skin jacket. Absolutely amazing. It appears to have... He's dressed like Catelyn Moran for some reason. I've absolutely no idea why he would do that. Let's wrap all this up now. I think it's time for us to go and enjoy Christmas. This is the last Music Weekly before Christmas, so the whole team here at Guardian Music. This is good. I can do this in my... I'm going to do it in the voice that Phil Spector does at the end of the Phil Spector Christmas album, which is the bit that you never get... No one ever plays that, I notice, on the record. Because he sounds exactly like a man who, in the future, will shoot someone in the face. This is the last Music Weekly before Christmas. So the whole team here at Guardian Music wish you a happy Christmas and thanks for listening. Thanks also to Rosie, as ever. Merry Christmas,
Merry
baby.
Merry Christmas.
And to Bob. Thank you for coming in, Bob. I hope you come in again.
Yes, I'd love
lovely,
to.
Lovely to drop in on us. We'll be back next week with a programme containing the best of the Music Weekly live tracks from 2010. On the 27th of December, God knows, by then you'll be so sick of Christmas, you'll be doing anything to listen in. So, yeah, it's available from 27th of December. Do listen in. That's all for now, though. I'm Alexis Petridis. The programme was produced by Scott Crawley. Happy Christmas, everyone. Bye-bye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/.